Welcome to the 51st birthday celebration of Overeaters Anonymous. We're glad you're here for the weekend's first long-timer panel discussion entitled OA, A Conscious Contact Sport. Our panelists will be sharing their experience, strength, and hope about how they work a spiritual program. My name is Jill, and I am a compulsive overeater and your leader for today's panel.
Hi, Jill.
Hello, everyone, and good morning. Please join me in the Serenity Prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Let's take a moment now to make certain that we turn off all cell phones or other electronic beeping devices. Our OA preamble states, Overeaters Anonymous is a fellowship of individuals who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and recover from compulsive overeating. The only requirement for OA membership is a desire to stop eating compulsively. There are no dues or fees for members, and we are self-supporting through our own contributions. OA is not affiliated with any religious sect or denomination, political organization, or institution. Our primary purpose is to abstain from compulsive overeating and to carry this message of recovery to those who still suffer. I have stated that I am a compulsive overeater. Are there any other compulsive overeaters present? Our three panelists will share their experience, strength, and hope on today's topic for 15 minutes each. Our timer in the front row will hold up signs indicating 2 minutes left and time's up. After panelists share, we will take questions. There are pencils, paper, and a few ask-it baskets circulating the room. Please write your question on a sheet of paper, fold it, and place it in the ask-it basket. Please indicate whether your question is addressed to a particular panelist or is open for anyone to respond. Please keep the ask-it basket circulating. Our first speaker is Tricia. Please join me in welcoming Tricia.
Good morning. My name is Tricia. I'm recovering a bulimic. And thank you all for coming this morning. And today's my half natal birthday, so thank you for celebrating with me. Usually when I share about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. So I'm going to apply that to higher power, how higher power came into my life. I was born into the Jewish religion, and we lived down the block from the temple. So that was always a really nice place to go. But the higher power that I had at the time was kind of punishing and fearful. However, I felt that there was a protection there. But I still had a loneliness that was dealt with mint chocolate chip snowballs, if you've ever had those, or boxes of chocolate bars because my dad had brought them home so we wouldn't do bad things like cross big streets to get to the candy store. When I was 7, I got an illness that I couldn't walk for about 2 months. And you can talk about powerless. I had no idea what was going on at the time. Literally having to crawl to get someplace is, you know, that really changes your perspective in terms of being grateful to being able to do things like walk. So for me, being healthy took another level of priority or appreciation, I think, in my life, just to be able to be healthy. And I had a dog, and that was my constant companion. He used to sit with me till my older siblings would come home from school. I would take naps with him, and he was a boxer. His name was Luke. And having my dog was a great consolation because other people were really busy in my family, you know, earning a living. And that feeling of loneliness seemed to have been something that was with me, or not being a part of, or being apart from, or not being included. And so that is something that comes up for me often. And Jewish girls didn't have bat mitzvahs in those days, and so that's sort of another being left out. I tried to do whatever was okay for me to do, but like I'm studying to have a bat mitzvah now. You know, at 64, I start. I've started at other times, but I don't know if it's because girls can do it too, or my appreciation for just that power greater than myself. I didn't come into OA because I had a problem with food. I came into OA because I was a friend. I was working on alcohol policy, and my friend said, you need to come to an AA meeting to understand the difference between AA perspective and alcohol policy. And I said, well, I don't want to go. People think I'm an alcoholic. She said, don't worry. They already think you are. But I could understand the way kids binge drink, the way I binge ate. So we agreed on my going to an OA meeting. And my cousin happened to be in town, and I didn't know that she was also a member of the program and also had the same illness I had. And so what I heard in those rooms was the not good enough feelings. I mean, that was very powerful for me. I had experiences in my life where I felt the powerlessness. I had a daughter that developed malaria in Africa. I mean, you want to talk about, you know, promising I'll be a good girl if she's okay. And my daughter being in Southeast Asia when the tsunami and the earthquake hit, you know, that's a really powerless feeling. I mean, you really realize that you don't have control over a lot of things. And there have been other health-related illnesses, and, you know, not being able to find my son in Manhattan at 9/11. These things, when you really realize how you have no control over things and you just have to be very fortunate, you know, and that, you know, I don't want to talk about religion, but in terms of that understanding that you don't know who's going to live and who's going to die, you know, when you hear that and you begin, the first time you usually go to that particular service is after someone very close to you has died, and you realize, you know, what you lost, you know, what you might have not really. I mean, I learned early in program to write a gratitude list, and so I'm grateful that I did write gratitude lists, that my family was intact, that everybody was healthy, you know, before some of these losses occurred. And we had a new rabbi at my temple, so I wanted to find out whether it was okay for Jews to go to church, to go to 12-step meetings, because, you know, where are the meetings? You know, well, my first meeting was at the community center, but, and my rabbi was wonderful. She gave me the name of some books by a rabbi, and she sent me to go hear a singer named Debbie Friedman at a retreat, and I cried that whole day. Debbie is this incredible singer, and she died recently. And her music was so spiritual. I'm learning Hebrew now. Now I'm beginning to understand, but her songs were in English and Hebrew, and the melodies, you know, were so powerful for me and so uplifting, that when, after my mom died, I could listen to that music and I would have a vessel for my grief. I would cry in the mornings. And so, you know, I've been on this journey to define what my higher power is, and I decided that the ocean, because I knew it was more powerful than I was, and babies, because babies are miraculous to me, you know, that as many of them come out, you know, as well as they are, is to me a miracle. And, you know, over time I've moved to the ocean, and to me that is such a power, and I have healthy children, I have grandchildren. To me, you know, I actually have the opportunity to grandbabysit three afternoons a week, and just, he's 9 months old. And to be able to almost reparent myself, I'm using him, sorry, to have somebody that unconditional love, and just being able to sit there and play with a book, you know, like just sit there, or he loves my red watch, you know. It is such a miracle, you know, that we appreciate those things in our lives. Certainly, you know, the problems haven't gone away. But my sponsor said to me, it's not serenity after, it's being serene through the things that go on in our life. And certainly many of us have really, you know, problems don't go away because you go to 12-step programs. I mean, I was bulimic for 28 years. I've been in recovery for 21. So that doesn't mean my food plan is in any way perfect. I haven't thrown up in 21 years except for the flu, taking my dog's medicine by accident because I'm allergic to sulfur. So I, you know, for me, my bottom line abstinence is not throwing up. And I decided that I could give myself, you know, it was okay, you know, I had food poisoning from fish. I somehow cannot tolerate certain kinds of fish, and it isn't pretty. So for me, there's one thing I have to confess is that I really haven't had sponsors. I have great sponsees. I have sponsors in more than one program, but it seems as if I don't have that skill. But I'm open to sponsoring. But to turn things over, like to me that's the next big step, is like to know that I don't have the answer, I don't have the control. You can do one step and then turn it over. And I've seen that plan A and plan B and plan C get progressively better. You know, I think we're going to do this, and it ends up being this, and then it ends up being that. And, you know, I couldn't come up with those ideas. You know, if I can turn it over, I mean, I can take sort of like the next right indicated action. But, and for me, that's some power greater than myself. That is gentle. I exchanged my punishing God for more of a Shekinah, which is in my mind, a sort of more of a force and a gentleness and, you know, feathers and blankets and hugging and warmth and light and just soft and fuzzy. You know, I'm the soft, fuzzy person. I have experienced a lot of verbal abuse in my household. Well, I shouldn't. It's like I want to share with you. I'm not sure I want it out there, you know, for everybody to hear this. But, you know, my father grew up in an abusive home. How much more time do I have? And so I think knowing how to be there for another person, like in another program, someone learning, apologizing for not being able to be there for another person for not being able to be there for them in a way that they needed you to be there for them. Sometimes we're just not matched. Sometimes, I mean, I was bulimic for a long time when my kids were growing up, so they didn't necessarily, I, you know, wasn't necessarily on their wavelength. And, you know, I try to listen better, more effectively, but I still, you know, have a different perception of reality than a lot of other people. And so I find that hearing other people's listening, not just, my son would say to me, Mom, he says, you're just waiting until I finish talking to say what you think. You're not hearing what I'm saying. And, understanding about experience, strength, and hope, I may tell you what I think you should do, but I have no idea. I've never been there. I've never been in your shoes. So I've learned. I've learned that, as my friend who's here in the room, someone told me, you know, you could always play dead. You know, that sounds like a terrible thing. But for those in the program, it's like, we don't have to say something. You know, we don't have to up the ante. You know, sometimes when somebody gets angry or when I get angry, I need to step back and I need to figure out what's going on for me. I need to write. I need to call a sponsor. I need to read some reading from the big book or the meditation books I keep in my car. I have a lifeline in my refrigerator. I am in more than one program. For those of you that may have heard this, I went to a meeting and someone said sometimes people with food problems have money problems. And it isn't so much the debting part of it, it's just the craziness around money issues. And you know, so I've been in that program too, and certainly my reactivity to other, I am emotionally reactive. You know, and I have to figure out what's going on for me, because the next thing is going to be eating over it. You know, sometimes I can compartmentalize it for a few hours, and then I ate somebody's box of Good and Plenty recently. I wouldn't even buy that. I mean, it's not chocolate. I mean, it's not a food that I would have, but I was really upset about something, and I'm still upset about it. It's like a week later, I'm still not over it. But my emotional reactivity is something that's real, and other people don't react emotionally as I do. And I don't think that's all bad, you know, but some people are more rational. I am not of the more rational school. I don't compartmentalize well. And I'm very grateful. I've had wonderful friends in this program, and people that have been there for me. You know, people have had experiences that they share with me that I would never share with anybody. You know, to go to a meeting and have people come over you afterwards and say, this is what worked for me. You know, like I usually like feedback. You know, if you're going to say it nicely, please. But it was very interesting to me that when my mom was dying and I was going to AA meetings in Miami, you know, when you're losing your mom, you know, that's a pretty big thing, you know, and to have people just share what it was like and how they dealt with it was a real gift, you know. And so I thank you all for being here. I'm very grateful for the program and all the people that have put time into me, you know. Thank you. I see a former sponsor. Thank you.
Thank you, Tricia. Our next speaker is Ida. Please join me in welcoming Ida.
Hi, my name is Ida. I'm a compulsive overeater.
Hi, Ida.
I started my pictures around. I've been an abstaining member of Overeaters Anonymous for 35 years. And I maintain between 110 and 115 pound weight loss. So I came in not pleasingly plump, let me put it that way. When I told my sponsor that I was going to be on a panel and that the topic was spirituality, she laughed. And this is a woman who's been my sponsor for 15 years. And she said, well, I guess you're going to have to give your speech. And I said, okay. And so this is my speech about my spirituality. First of all, I want to say that I took the first half of step one in the spring of 1965, and that was long before I ever got to program. But in the spring of 1965, I found myself in a new college. My father had just bled to death from alcoholism. I weighed about 180 pounds. I was down 60 pounds. Using diet pills. I was taking 21 diet pills a day, 7 at each meal, and binging my head up. And I found out through the news media that people were dying of taking these diet pills, and I decided that if I couldn't be thin without diet pills, I was going to be fat for the rest of my life. And I threw away the diet pills. And I fought the good battle every once in a while, but for most of that time, until I got to Overeaters Anonymous, I was pretty resigned to the fact that I was going to be fat. Now, it took another 10 years of living before I was able to take the second half of step one and admit that my life was unmanageable, that it was just a hopeless mess, and that there was some relationship between that hopeless mess and the weight that I was carrying. And I believe I took step one about the minute before I called Overeaters Anonymous. And with my phone call to OA on April 16th, 1975, I took step two. I came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity, and that power was Overeaters Anonymous. But I had to continue step two by walking into my first meeting, because by the time I walked into my first meeting, 4 days after my phone call, I had 4 days of abstinence. I knew I was going to get thin, and I was beginning to wonder if I could just do this on my own one more time. But there was a woman at my school, I was a teacher, who had 12-stepped me, and she was going to be at school that Monday after telling me about meetings. And I thought maybe I should go to a meeting, because it would be very embarrassing to tell her on Monday that I hadn't been to a meeting. So in a way, she was my first higher power. And I walked up the stairs to that first meeting, and I not only took step two, I took step three right there. And the proof that I took step three right there at my first meeting was that I've been abstaining ever since. So there. My first higher power in this program was Overeaters Anonymous, the meeting. And I heard that at a meeting, because I came to the program with no concept of I had a concept of a God, but it wasn't a very nice one. And actually, I fancied myself an existentialist, and I was going through life in existential loneliness. It wasn't isolation, it was existential loneliness. And I was very much the intellectual, and I wanted to believe in God, but I just didn't think there was anything out there, particularly anything that cared for me as an individual. But I came into program, and I heard people say that you can have the group as your higher power, and I went, oh, thank heaven, and I decided that the group would be my higher power. It took me a while to read the big book, because I came into program with such a burning resentment of alcoholics, having grown up in an alcoholic home, and I just had no tolerance for people who of that persuasion. And here I was about to base my life on a book written by a bunch of drunks. Oh my God. So I pretty much sat on my hands for 5 months working. I abstained. I lost 50 pounds. I guess you can't call that sitting on your hands, but I did nothing else about the second half of step one. And one night I had a physical problem where I passed out, threw up all over myself, couldn't move, and became thoroughly paralyzed. Couldn't move, because the minute I moved a finger, I would throw up again, and I realized nobody would miss me if I died. So I decided to work the 12 steps, and that week I got myself a sponsor, and I promptly turned my life and my will over to the care of my sponsor. And luckily, I got one who was sane about 80% of the time, which is not bad in this program. And she took me through the big book, and she taught me the process of the 12 steps. And today, that is my higher power, the process of the 12 steps. I do not have a loving God who takes care of me. I do not have an intervening God. I don't have any entity to pray to. But I have a program that works without failure when I turn to it. And that is what I do. Whenever I am in trouble, I turn to the process of the 12 steps, which in essence for me means writing inventory, giving it away, making amends, etc. So how did I get to that? When I came into program, I said I turned my will over to my first sponsor, and she was very old school. Well, this was in 1975, and actually there wasn't much old school in OA, because none of us were very old. I mean, OA was 15 years old when I came into program. But she was of the opinion that newcomers needed to, shut up. She didn't want to hear anything I had to say, because I didn't know anything. And she did all the talking, and I thank God for that because I really didn't know anything. And she taught me the big book. And she taught me about opening my mouth and letting the truth out, because this woman was not only a member of OA, she was a member of AA, she had lived on Skid Row, she had done all kinds of stuff I could only dream of. And she told me things that I couldn't believe I could ever say out loud, or anybody could say out loud. And so she gave me the willingness to just tell everything about myself. And I've pretty much told everything about myself from the podium. There are a couple things that are between me and my sponsor, and that's the way they're going to stay. And I'm not even going to give you a clue as to what they were about. But there isn't anything about me that somebody doesn't know. My first sponsor taught me some spiritual truths that were very hard to hear. She was very willing to tell me the difficult truth. She told me when I gave away my inventory that with the burning of my inventory, all of my reasons for eating were gone, and that all I had were excuses. She told me that I had no right to use anyone for my personal growth, even with their permission. And she told me that the day after my first birthday, I would just get up and abstain again. And those were very hard things to hear. But they were the truth, and they still are my truth today. So after a while, I did develop a personal God. I come from a self-created religious background. My parents were Italian immigrants, brought the Catholic Church with them to America, but they got married outside of the church, and they didn't go to church. In fact, my father was, the term is called anti-clerical. Some of you may know that term. That was my father's position on it, on the church. And then I came along, and it just came to me. And from age five on, I was a religious fanatic. There was no, and you know what? When I came into program, I became an OA fanatic, and it stood me well. I've just got that in me, and I have to watch it very carefully. So, but I dropped all of that when I got into my 20s. For a lot of different reasons, but I left the church and I dumped the God bit with the church. So when I came to program, I started opening up to the idea that there was a God, and for several years, I had a pretty decent relationship with this higher power, but it never fit into what I heard at program at meetings. My higher power did not intervene. The only thing my higher power did was to work on my attitude. And that's the only thing I prayed for, was my attitude. Several years ago, we had a rat infestation in our house, a real one. Rats in my clothes, in my stove, under my bed, rats, rats, rats. And it lasted a year and a half. I don't know how our marriage survived, because I let my husband take care of the rats. That would not happen today. I would be getting those suckers, trust me. But during that whole time, I never prayed for the rats to be removed, because I took step three and step 11, praying only for the knowledge of his will and the power to carry that out. I did not pray for anything specific for myself, because the minute I stepped into that area, it became a wish list, a Santa's list, you know, an I want letter. And it was for me at that time an attempt to control what God was going to do for me. So I never prayed for the rats to be removed. I prayed for my attitude towards the rats to be right. oh, shit, that is not, you know. So anyhow, so this continued, and then after about, 20 or so years of this, and every night I would get on my knees when I would go to bed, every night. And then I began to feel some dis-ease going to bed and doing this, because I felt like it was an empty gesture. And about 10 years ago, I got on my knees and I thought, what are you doing here? What are you doing? And I got up, and I haven't done it since. I just gave up. I just gave up the idea of an entity out there taking care of me. And nothing changed. I continued to abstain. My marriage didn't fall apart. My religious sponsees didn't flee. And nothing happened. There was no change. Except that I was being more honest with myself. And I started talking about it from the podium, and lo and behold, people started coming with me. Guess what? I'm the same, you know, or guess what? You mean you can abstain and not believe in a specific God? And I go, yeah, I sure can, because I have the process of the 12 steps. And step 3 says, God as we understand him. Doesn't it? So, either the people who wrote that step meant it, or they didn't. Either they meant it, or they were hypocrites. So, there we are, and my time is up. Oh. But that's it. Thank you.
Thank you, Ida. Our final speaker is Carol. Please join me in welcoming Carol.
Hi, I'm Carol. I'm a compulsive reader. I, too, when I found out I was on this panel, I laughed. And then when I saw Ida was on this panel, I really laughed. Because I'm an atheist, and I don't believe in God either. Which is not the way I came in this program. It's not the way I... So if you've got a God and you're... All I can say is, don't get too used to it, because it's going to change throughout your entire length of absence. Oh, to qualify. My top weight is somewhere around 325 pounds, and I have 32 years of abstinence. So over the 32 years, my higher powers changed a lot. It's interesting that Edith's on this panel with me, because when Edith first pitched from the podium that she was an atheist, I had a major resentment. And I thought, that she needs to sit down, because she is spreading an evil corroded thread through the program. Because I had a belief in this power, this God thing. And I even told a sponsee once, you need to get this concept of a God, and you need this so you can always go back to this God, so you can pray to this God that when you get in trouble, you have this concept of God. Well, here I am several years later, and I guess I moved over to Eda's camp. It didn't start that way. I mean, I started as I don't know what I was. I was raised Baptist. I'm a gay man, so that really didn't go hand in hand very much towards the for a while. Christ still doesn't. When I came into the program, I really didn't have much of a belief in God. Maybe not. I don't know. You know, it wasn't important in my life. I prayed to God when I was young that, you know, have me wake up thin and have my parents stop drinking and fighting, and I'd wake up fat and they'd still drink and fight. So I was like, you know, I got to deal with God. God hated me. So that's kind of like I just left God alone. God left me alone. But I found out something very interesting when I came to program. I found that if I talked about put God in my pitch, you guys liked my pitch. And I'm a people pleaser. So I talked a lot about God. I mean, I talked a lot about God, because that way you'd be coming, oh my God, it was a wonderful pitch. It was a, and it's like, but the fact of the matter is, I don't know if it was there, but what happened is this panic started sinking in. So I got this concept about God. Then I wound up, you know, I believe in the party line, you know, you can make God whatever. I went to a meeting in Pasadena, Texas, which is where the home of the Ku Klux Klan Nazi Party is. And I spoke at this meeting, I was about 3-4 years abstinent. And I said, you know, if you want to make your God this chair, make your God this chair. And this woman stood up in the middle of the meeting and said, that's blasphemy, and stormed out. And then the speaker got up and apologized to the meeting because he asked me to speak. He heard a lot of weight loss, but didn't know anything else about me. And once again, that's where this, where we look at, we have this concept of God and what God is, and we're trying to impose this. Just like I had to make Ida impose that she had to have a God. She had to have a God that was my understanding, not her understanding. This woman who stood up with blasphemous, oh, and by the speaker, the secretary who apologized, couldn't find out it was his wife that stood up in the middle of the meeting and said blasphemy and stormed out. Which devastated me, by the way, because, you know, in the meeting you're supposed to be safe and not be picked on. And I guess that was called crosstalk when she got up and stood up and called blasphemy. So it was devastating to me because, once again, this meeting is this. When we come to OA, we come here because we can find safety. We can find a sense of security that we will not be judged here, that we will not be picked on here, that we will not be ostracized here, that when we walk in the doors, we can drop the shame. Because we are among our fellows. We are among the rest of us. And so it developed over time that my higher power, and I've gone through many different higher powers, went to outside sources. I had a Hindu guru for a while. I've been spiritually seeking. What really screwed me up with my God was the 2000 election. Because I heard a lot of talk about God. And God was used a lot against me. As a gay man. And God, and I'm using God over here, and they're using God over there, and it's things like, ugh, it just made me crazy. And then 9/11 happened, and you go, like, you hear God again, and God made these people fly into buildings. And it just kind of, it didn't set well. And I watched a lot of the history, Discovery Channel, you know, and that's kind of screwed me up, because there's the Big Bang Theory, and then there's, like, these membranes, and who knows what God is. But as Ida said, I got honest. And I don't believe in a power greater or an entity or a being or that can pray to you for a parking space. What I believe is the 12 steps. Because I'm still lasting at 32 years without a supreme being that I pray to, without a deity. But I go lead these retreats. And on Sunday morning I do this whole spiritual thing about talking about God. And I use the word God now because it's a very convenient word because everyone kind of gets it, has their own version of a God. Now, if I say God, you know, you've got something going on in your head and Eva's got something going on in her head and I got something going on in my head. But it's a common word that we can all use. Now, it doesn't mean that what you see is what I think. I learned a long time ago, I once spoke at a meeting. This woman came up to me after I spoke at a meeting and she want to thank me because she stayed abstinent in Europe because she kept saying, if Cheryl can stay abstinent in Europe, she could stay abstinent in Europe. Now, if y'all, those of you that know my story, I binged my way through Europe, gained 30 pounds in 6 weeks, stuff in my face, thinking, after a doctor told me I'd be blind within a year if I didn't stop eating sugar, stuff in my face full of sugar when I can still see, and when things go great, that's when I'll stop. But the woman stayed abstinent because she knew if Cheryl could stay abstinent in Europe, she could stay absent in Europe. I didn't have the heart to tell her, oh, honey. So what I say from the podium and what you hear are two different things. And I'm very clear about that. But when we talk about God, we can talk about God. So when we talk about God, I do this thing where I get up and do like this whole diagram. And go. Basically, I draw a line. On one side, I put God. The other side, I put the human ego. Because I can either live my life based upon the human ego, or I can live my life based upon a God-centered self, or a God self, or a higher sense of self, or whatever you want to call good orderly direction. God is void of self. All these things. So on one side I list attributes of the human ego, and the other side I list attributes of God. And on the God side I'll put love, peace, serenity, calmness, sanity, joyfulness, sharing, group experience. On the other side, for ego, I'll put, this is the group throws it out at me because I don't have all the words, and this is a way, it's an interactive thing. And on the other side, we list attributes to the human ego: fear, anxious, small, food, need, lack, deprivation. So if I look at that list and go like, what am I going to turn my will and my life over the care of? Fear, anger, resentment, or hope, trust, faith? Faith that things are going to get better. And I find that when I turn my will, my life over the care of that power, that God, my life is better. That I call it a miracle, because a miracle for me is a shift in perception. Because what happens is before I came into Overeaters Anonymous, I believed that food was the answer. That food somehow, some way, one more time, would make the hurt go away. Then there was a miracle in my life. There was a shift in my perception. And I realized that food was not the answer. That no matter how many times I eat one more donut, I was not going to take away the hurt. That all it does is cause more hurt. That is a miracle. That is a miracle. I believe in the way this program works. This program, I read this article about the 12-step program and what 12-step programs do. It gives us a sense of community because we're all one here. It's cognitive therapy where you talk out what's going on with you. That's noted. Cognitive therapy is noted to work. We do service, which gives us a higher sense of self, a higher sense of purpose. That creates a sense of community, and that also takes away the hurt. The reason why I'm a compulsive overeater, and the reason why I'm an Overeaters Anonymous, is because I was uncomfortable in my own skin. I was terribly uncomfortable. I was living my life based upon fear, upon anxiety, on the victimization of what those people did and how I had to prove how horrible they did by being so right to make my life so miserable to prove the point how bad it was. Shift in perception, a miracle. I don't have to prove myself anymore to how bad life was. I had a lousy childhood. Can we get on with the business of living? You know, this came to me, and I just love this thing that was, you know, the whole thing about, I'm verging, about the, you know, about compulsory just complaining, like they got to take the tiger out, and you got to eat. You know, you got to eat. And I heard from the podium the other day, said, yeah, but you don't have to eat that way. You know, we all have to eat, but we don't have to eat that way. This program, when I walked in, gave me a promise that said that I never, ever have to binge again. Now, the reason why I never, ever have to binge again, because it gives me a program for living. A program. We call it a program for a reason, because it's a program to live my life. And if I live my life based upon the 12 steps, the 12 traditions, and work the 8 tools, if I live my life based upon that, I don't want to overeat. It takes away the discomfort. It takes away the hurt. It takes away the anxiety. Because as a compulsive overeater, anxiety makes me want to eat. Cheerfulness makes me want to eat. I mean, happiness makes me want to eat. I mean, to me, food is a party. Bottom line, food is a party. Whether it's a wake, whether it's a funeral, whether it's an anniversary, whether it's a quiet evening at home, food is a party. Because it takes my mind away from what's going on. So what I've learned in this program, what you folks told me, is you take away that hurt, that hole in our soul, that what I'm trying to fill with food, we take that away, and we won't want to overeat. We won't have that desire. When old-timers talk about we've lost that desire to eat compulsively, recoil from like a hot flame, we look at that and go like, why would I do that to myself? Why would I overeat like that? Why? The pain is so god-awful. But if you tell that to a newcomer who's got, you know, and y'all know, I believe in newcomers, 10 years or less of abstinence. You know, if you tell a newcomer, especially someone in their first year, baby, that desire to eat compulsively will be removed. It was that it will be, they'll look at that like, oh, my, how does that work? Well, because you haven't, they haven't worked the program long enough to reprogram the brain, to rework ourselves. Because that's what this program tells us. It tells us to go change, to rework ourselves, so we have to eat. Now, that to me is a spiritual act. I was thinking, like, what is a spiritual act? Well, wearing this t-shirt is a spiritual act for me. Why? Because it's an R2 retreat or R2 convention thing. Now, I'd much rather wear something cute that, you know, blah, 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 that just came from my wardrobe, you know, to show off and so forth. But because I want to do the higher good, because I'm looking to get the higher good, that I want to advertise the R2 convention, that I'm wearing this shirt not to be, because my human ego would say, oh, it's blah, 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 you know, don't, oh, geez, it's like white, oh, you know. But my spiritual self will go, Terrell, it's for a better purpose. You wear this for a higher purpose. And by wearing it for a higher purpose, I get more comfortable in my own skin. Because if I didn't wear the shirt today, but knowing that I was suggested that we wear, that committee members wear their shirts, I'd be sitting here full of, well, what were those people talking about out there? What about that anxiety? You know what that's going to make me do? It's going to make me hungry at lunch. I don't know why. I'm just so hungry. I want a little bit more at lunch. Because I live my life based upon fear. That is why I work a 12-step program. So I do not live my life based upon fear. The flip side then, as we say, the flip side of fear is faith. I believe that life will get better. Not right here, right now, but overall. Well, my favorite saying is a sign of someone's spirituality is not what happens to them, but how they respond to it. Thanks for letting me share.
All right. Thank you, panelists. It is now time for questions. We will stop at 9:55. For everyone on the panel. What would you say to newcomers who ask you about finding a higher power? Funny.
Well, for me, I just took the parts of what I thought a higher power should be, you know, that I was powerless, and I knew that the ocean was more power than I was, and that babies, for me, were miracles, and so those seem to be the elements of a higher power for me. That was what embodied those things.
Well, when I'm newcomers don't talk to me.
But what I would tell a newcomer if they ask, and I tell people, I get calls from people who are having problems with their God concept, and they're blaming that for not being able to abstain, and I tell them that abstain anyhow, come to the program anyhow, just skip that stuff. You know, and just get on with the rest of it. Because, you know, my sponsor told me the only way I know I've done 1, 2, and 3 is by doing 4 and after. So just forget it and see how it goes.
Bottom line, don't eat. Bottom line, don't eat. You know, I see a lot of people use the 12 steps. The thing I say is, are you using the 12 steps as a measuring stick or a whipping stick? And I see a lot of people use the concept in the program to beat themselves up that they're not good enough. Really, that their God is not good enough, not perfect enough. I used to say, you can use my God. My God's big enough.
I guess it is. It's, you know, it's the membranes that combine the, you know, the Big Bang Theory. Who knows? I mean, if you ask, I mean, we don't know what God is. But all we can say is, just act like as if there's something power, a power greater than you. And you'll be surprised. You'll be surprised. But just don't eat.
Oh, I do tell them that they do have a higher power, and that's food if they're eating.
Yeah.
So you believe in a higher power whether, you know, you know it or not.
Thank you. I think this is a good one. How do, and we have many good questions, I don't know if we have time for everything, though. How, this is for all of you guys, how do you sponsor? What do you do if your sponsee doesn't follow your directions? Thank you.
I hope they fire me. Be one less person to sponsor. I mean, you know, it's the other thing. I just look at them straight in the face and go, like, you know what? Why are you asking me? If you're not going to do what I say, why are you asking me? You know, they, some of them gave me a hard time with me being an atheist. They want to convince me that I'm agnostic, you know. And they go, like, well, whatever you pray to, like, I'm like, and I'll tell them something, like, ask God to help you, you know. But if they don't do what you say, you know, our literature is very clear. Read Working with Others. It says if they're not doing what you suggest, have them move on. Don't do yourself a favor. I mean, don't cater to your human ego to try and keep them or try to rescue them or try to make them, because you're not the answer. The program is the answer. So if you're trying to hang on and convince a baby to do what you want them to do, I'd say your human ego's involved. They're going to figure it out sooner or later.
Tricia, could you please tell your journey from bulimia to stopping?
Interestingly enough, I was living in Beverly Hills, and there was a, they started this campaign about healthy choices, that you could make a healthy choice every day, like you made a mistake yesterday, but you could start fresh every day. And I don't know, that idea kind of helped me realize that, you know, I wanted to cut down, I sort of slowly cut down on throw, you know, I would say I'm going to keep the food in no matter what. That I would, if I mean, I don't want to share this because I don't want to upset anybody, but I was a successful bulimic because I was thin. And when I stopped throwing up, I gained weight. So I don't want you to know that because it might deter you. It deterred me. But I just knew that this wasn't healthy. You know, I don't know why it took me so long, 28 years, to figure out it wasn't healthy. I mean, I'm a health professional. Somewhere along the line, I might have noticed that. But my kids were my binge buddies. That's not nice. You know, talking about... I had originally been an anorexic, but my dentist told me he had not seen scurvy since the war. So in 10th grade, I learned about the vomitoriums in Rome. So, but, you know, I realized that it just wasn't healthy. It wasn't a good thing. It's not like I was perfectly happy. So it's just kind of like a one day at a time thing, you know, it just... And there were so, I mean, 28 years. I mean, there were so many days of, tomorrow's going to be different. I'm not going to do this. And, you know, it took what it took. You know, I was talking to my daughter about, I sent an email to my kids, what would you think I should say? And my daughter said, you know, because I'm going to be seeing today. And she said, well, say what you think would have helped you. I don't know that... I was ready when I was ready, and I wasn't ready instantaneously. I was, you know, what's the word they use, like motivationalist you. It's like you sort of move on, you know, it doesn't happen. Well, for me, my spiritual experience was it didn't happen overnight, you know, and I by no means have a perfect eating behaviors now. But it was incremental. It's a with educational experience, I think, is with James Clark.
Thank you. Last question, you guys. How has programs for all of you helped you during your most important / difficult moments of your life?
Well, I've spent, you know, 35 years in programs, so you can imagine a lot of life has hit. My mother died. I've lost 2 brothers and 2 sisters. My husband has had major medical issues. Just had a tremendous amount of stuff happen, and the fellowship of Overeaters Anonymous has never let me down. When my husband had cancer surgery, there were people from the program there with me, and if they couldn't be there, their husbands were there. And they were just always there. We hear, I want to give a pitch for the fellowship. We hear people say, well, the recovery is in the steps, and the recovery is, you know, in the big book and in the program. Well, except that we don't get to any of that without the fellowship. And the fellowship of this program is incredibly powerful, and it may be the secret as to how, why it works, because of the identification and the fact that, you know, we are no longer alone. I haven't had to go through anything alone. Nothing alone. So, you know, you guys are the 12 steps of recovery with arms.
Acceptance. Really, you know that saying that pain is not in the struggle. The pain is not in the surrender, it's in the struggle. I've had to learn to accept that life is not a bed of roses. I've learned to accept that life is not always pretty. That life is life. It just happens. And the 12 steps have enabled me to go like, okay, this is not the way it's going to be the rest of the life. My rest of the world is going to be like, I heard this great pitch from this friend where they talked about, she said, like, before she came to program, she's like Eeyore. All is lost. There is no hope. All is lost. And program has taught me that this too shall pass. And that I can change my attitude about what is happening. If I can change my attitude and go into acceptance, then I'm not butting my head up against life constantly going like, why is it not the way I want it to be? And that's whether sometimes it's 32 years, as you said. I have a hole in me. A whole litany of things that God could have eaten over. But the bottom line is, what would have gotten? Same problems, same thing. Next morning, full of shame, regret, self-hatred. Might as well abstain through it. Get through this side, because if they're the same, I know I can get through this. No matter what. No matter what. And there's been some god-awful things.
For me, with the second step, you know, that part about being restored to sanity, like, I skipped that for a while because, you know, that didn't apply to me. And, you know, realizing that I was bulimic for 28 years, I have a mental health problem as well as a little substance abuse on the side, you know, and I had to deal with that reality for me. And that was hard. That was hard for me to be accepting and, you know, and how that interplayed in my life, in my daily living. Do you know what I mean? And, you know, it's something that I had to come back to. It's like really embarrassing. It's like, I don't want you to know about it. It's like years in OA before I even mentioned the B word. So, you know, I had a lot of shame about this disease and, you know, people sharing in the rooms. The first person I heard say about their not good enough feelings. It was really important to me that we were all here, and your stories were probably just as embarrassing to you as mine were to me. And I'm grateful that people would have that much honesty, because I certainly didn't want anyone to know this.
Thank you. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have. It is now time to close the meeting. Let's thank Tricia, Vita, and Carol.